Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Oh, there we go. Well, hello, everybody. How you doing this evening? Hope you've had a great week. I had a chance to go out and see Disclosure Day yesterday, and I will say I was very, very pleased with it. I thought that, and I know a lot of people aren't. My brother isn't. Love you, brother. Happy birthday yesterday, man. Hope you had a great day. Sorry you didn't like Disclosure Day the way I did. I honestly thought that it did a great job tackling some of the issues within the community, specifically issues with experiencers. I thought that it brought up some very interesting points on experiencer. Even the fact that it used the word experiencer is fantastic, and brings things to a different light. I think a lot of people were disappointed because it's that, you know, people expect things. People want like some... I don't know. I guess I think a lot of it is also a rapier from Steven Spielberg saying, hey, people, please back off. I am not some like red in person on these programs. I'm just a director who occasionally hires like somebody like Jacques Vallée or, you know, Alan J. Hynek to come advise on my movie, you know. Nothing more. And I talk to actual experiencers to get their stories and learn things like terminology like experiencer is important. So I thought it was great. Steven, fantastic job. Open invite, my friend. Feel free to hop on. In the second part of tonight, we will be joined after our commercial break by our good friend Ryan Edwards. We will be taking on a huge topic right now that is near and dear to my heart. I am a fan of AI. Don't get me wrong. I love it as a tool. I use it. I use it for all kinds of things, but it is a massive issue within the para community. Everything from cryptozoology to paranormal investigation to UFO UAP sightings. This is a massive issue going on right now, and we've already had the issue of the internet to begin with, and fakery and charlatans and things like that, because they always existed, folks. It was the job of Harry Houdini originally to like root out spiritualists who were doing horrible things, and that's just it. There are people out there that have ill will, that have ill gains to get from things, you know, views on YouTube, stuff like that. And they don't care what rabbit hole they take you down. They don't care what horrible thing they do to your life. And that's one of the things that we at this show have a huge, huge stance on. And it's one of the reasons why I say regularly that I wear my capital S skeptic, like Superman, like on my chest, ready to go. I believe I'm a believer because I've had my experiences in life, but because of that, my realm of what I consider evidence must be higher. My data has to be better because of that. I have to make sure that I'm not investigating something to confirm my belief in things. And when it comes to people who are purposefully trying to steer you wrong, who don't care, things like that, the world of spiritualism and the world of mediumship is a huge one. So when we talk to mediums on this show, we try to make sure that they are vetted mediums, that they are people that we know within communities have great standing, people like our guest here in the first segment, who we will be talking about tarot with. I'm a tarot user, folks, if you're not aware. I am not a spread user, things like that. And that's what we'll be getting into, is some of the demystification on this topic and tarot as a tool, not just as a tool of divination, like most people consider it. So welcome to the show for the first time, Julie Adriani. How are you doing this evening?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
I love the topic because tarot, I think, gets a bad name. Or a lot of people, they will work with oracle cards, but they're afraid of the tarot cards. They feel the weight. And they do come with a lot of history and knowledge, and I think that's what they're tapping into. But using them as a tool in your everyday life or your work, they can be so helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I regularly talk about the tarot whenever I have Gretchen Cornwall on. Hi, Gretchen, if you're watching tonight. Gretchen Cornwall is a Knights Templar researcher. And Knights Templar history is rife in the tarot. And the tarot, quite literally, is an esoteric system. It's a means by which to, and what that means out there, folks, who may be new to the term esoteric or esoteric system. An esoteric system is basically a means by which to transmit a mystical knowledge to those who are schooled in the symbology, to those who understand what these things mean on a deeper level. And when you start looking at the tarot specifically, it is rife with symbology. And that's how I use it as a tool, Julie. I don't travel with my tarot cards. My tarot deck stays here. I have two decks. I'm a right weight user till the day I die. But aside from that, my brother gave me a Thoth deck, and I really appreciate the art in that. It's beautiful. And they all have different art, the basic symbology of the cards and the meanings and stuff like that, but the symbology taken in different ways. So you can use what moves you, but I understand what you mean when people say the weight of the cards themselves, because there is whenever you get into traditional Rider-Waite, stuff like that, there is a huge compendium of meaning, not only to each card, but to the way each card changes to the card related around it. The way things change to the spread that you're using, if you're using a spread. And I do not use tarot as a tool of divination in my life. I use tarot as a tool of meditation. So I will basically draw a card. I use I'm a big user of Galaxy Tarot, which is an app. You can get it for cell phone. Okay. You can get it for Android. But it's great. And they have a thing that's like a card a day. And it's basically randomly picking a card for you every day. And whenever I'm on the road, that's what I use for my meditation instead of my actual deck. But every day I draw a card and I take 5 minutes and I just sit and I look at it and I think about it and I think about the symbology and what the meaning of the card means. I don't go reversed or anything like that. We'll get into those meanings.
I don't either. That's funny. I just don't read the reverse cards.
Yeah.
I just never have felt the need to.
Same here. I think it is an intricacy that's way too much. And once again, if it was the fact, if I was using it for a point of divination in that kind of way, or doing a traditional 10 card, 7 card spread, you know, what have you, past, present, future reading, whatever. In that right, maybe I would use the reversed meanings, you know, because at that point, yeah, a reverse card can make a difference compared to what's around it, you know. But for what I'm using it for, I have no need for a reversed meaning. I am looking at the art of the deck, the things like, is it related to earth, wind, fire? You know, those kind of things, what the meaning means and how I can take that meaning through my day, how I can connect it through my day, kind of like reading your horoscope in the morning and looking to see how that reflects out through your day. So
yes.
Give us a little bit of the history of the tarot and how you came in your history. How did you come to using tarot to begin with? And how did you come to the world of mediumship, Julie?
Well, I've been a medium since I was a child, able to see spirits. So I actually came to the cards much later in life. I did use oracle cards in the 90s, but there was something about the tarot that just felt at that time, like I said, heavier or more mysterious. So I was just ready one day and I started to use them, and everything even opened up more for me with my mediumship, because every time that you're using your psychic, because a lot of people will argue, some people even told me, well, that's a crutch. Don't use that. It's a crutch for your mediumship. And I didn't agree because I was already doing mediumship. But so the more you practice, every time you use your pineal gland, you light up. You're lighting up your senses. You're opening yourself up to more. And the more you practice, the better your mediumship will get. It's like it goes hand in hand, because you're learning or journeying like you do into a card for meditation or relaxation. I know a lot of people that meditate with the cards to open up their creativity, that might be musicians or writers. There's just something about tuning into the elements in the card or the symbology, and it really does open you up. It opens up your clairs. It's like psychic sit-ups. It's your intuition is a muscle. So the more you tune into the cards, the more you use it, the better you're going to be. It opens up your clairvoyance, really blows it right open if you're going to practice it. And the thing, I'll go over the clairs in case some of our audience doesn't understand what the clairs are.
Please.
But so we all have these clair senses. Sight, vision would be clairvoyance. Okay. Our hearing is audition. So clairaudience, when we hear things. Taste would be flavors or gustations. So they're called clairgustants. Smells, clairsalience. And then just sometimes you just know things, right? You know it. You don't know how you know it, but you know it. So that is claircognizance. You just know it. And then you get a feeling. So that could be a gut feeling, or it could be an inside feeling. So a lot of people think that the clairs are only used in psychic work, but our clairs belong to our soul. So the more we use them for psychic work, the more they light up for our mediumship work as well. So we can see things with our clairvoyance. Objectively would be outside, seeing with your physical eyes, but subjectively would be seeing in your mind's eye.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a difference. And like how I work as a physical medium, you want to see things objectively with your physical eyes. But even with like the feeling with mediumship, and when you're using your clairsentience, you can have those inside feelings too. I mean, you could be touched, you could feel things on the outside, but you can actually feel what a spirit is trying to show you, maybe how they passed. You might for a little while feel the pain, maybe chest pain from a heart attack, or you might feel knee pain, so that you can give your client evidence that this person suffered from right knee pain or had, you know, surgery, or say an accident. Then they might even taste blood in their mouth, the medium. So by working with the tarot, it's like exercising your intuition and your clairs. And it just helps open you up to everything. Have you ever heard of a reference library?
I have a massive reference library here at my house, but I think you're talking more in the idea of like almost like a sacred space to go to. Is that what you mean?
What I mean is, so by studying and using the cards, looking and, you know, learning about the symbols, feeling into the cards, you're creating a reference library. And what that means, it's a collection of experiences that each one of us has. So memories, symbols, okay, emotions, maybe cultural differences. Or our personal associations, things like that. So those are all things in our own personal reference library that when we're working as a medium, the spirits can bring up. If we have and know all these symbols that are in the tarot and a lot of the numerology, if we can tune into that, it makes spirit communication so much easier because it's there in your mind and your consciousness, and it's easier for them to pull it up.
Okay. And, you know, we talk regularly on this show about remote viewing. So the concept of clairsentience, the idea of having other senses and your senses being even tied to your sixth sense, and being able to, because I remember the first time that it happened to me when I was in the middle of a remote viewing session where I tasted salt water.
Oh, God.
Where it was like going to the beach and tasting it in the breath that you're taking in, where it was like, oh, wow. And the first time that I've smelled water in that kind of way, as well, in a session. And it's fascinating to think about that. And yeah, whenever you begin to, and I would say, yes, tarot is a fantastic tool to do this with, because once again, it really helps you drill down on focusing on something. And being open, slowing down, taking time, because that's a huge part of mediumship, period. And I wouldn't claim that I'm a medium. I would say I'm definitely empathic in some ways. But aside from that, I am a kind of like college. I am a C student remote viewer, Julie. I know people that are amazing, like Rhodes Scholar remote viewers, people who teach sessions, all kinds of stuff.
Yes.
And I know numerous mediums, things like that. But this is the first time that, and I've only met a couple of remote viewers who have told me that they use tarot as a point of meditation before they do a session. Not as a, like, hey, this is a part of my session, in any kind of way, or looking for information regarding the session, but more as a way to center themselves.
Yes.
More as like a meditative centering tool, like what we're talking about, where once again, because they can get deep into that symbology and really start working that side of the brain that is tied with that guttural instinct, and it's different because when you start remote viewing and when you start doing mediumship and things, there's an interesting connection that happens. And I saw it happen at a remote viewing class that I was at, where many of the people there were here locally in Austin were mediums that came to it. And their approach to remote viewing was very different than mine,
yes.
Which comes from like the Lynn Buchanan controlled remote viewing, like no, let's get those stray cats out of your head. We did, like, what were your precogs? Let's get them out now. That kind of stuff. Whereas they were very used to a mediumship point of view, where all of that comes in as one download, and there's no separation or compartmentalization of data as things move down the line. And it was interesting to see that difference in real time for the first time ever, because I'd seen mediums, I'd had them on my show, I'd seen remote viewing, I'd practiced it, I'd done stuff, but I'd never seen mediums learning remote viewing in that kind of way, and see the way that those things go hand in hand like that. Where,
yes, I attempted a remote viewing class, like a Lynn Buchanan type of class, and it wasn't working for me because of my way that I will work with my spirit team.
Yeah.
If a spirit comes in, you know, and wants somebody to look upstairs in a drawer on the left side for a ring or a piece of jewelry or something.
Yeah.
They just show me, or they'll just walk me through.
Yep.
So I have a whole different way. So it was a little difficult because it's a whole different
way. And I can completely hear the medium from Poltergeist. Y'all mind stepping back? You're jamming my frequencies. You know, that's exactly what that method does to somebody like you. Even though it may be a great tool in the toolbox and something to lean on, but if that's the kind of mediumship and clairsentient experience that you're used to having, then yeah, it would definitely be a stumbling block. And I've even found it was a great onboarding for me. And I recommend anybody that wants to practice remote viewing, learn controlled remote viewing first. Learn that protocoled way. And then there's numerous disciplines afterward that will open it up. But you've got to learn that compartmentalization when you're talking remote viewing as opposed to mediumship or a clairvoyant session. You know, and that idea of focusing in on that kind of thing, focusing in on something, using a tool to hit that meditative state, that point of separating, because like you said, in your experience and how you communicate with your spirit guides, you're hearing things like, go upstairs, there's a ring on the left. You know, in remote viewing, we would hear or feel or see, go upstairs left and ring. And as soon as you said ring, it'd be like, or gold ring or wedding ring or something like, wait, hold on, no, go back, let's take that back a step, because you've given it a definition, you've used a noun. Let's take that out. You can't project onto that what it might be, you know, in that kind of way. Whereas in mediumship, no, absolutely. My spirit guide said it's a gold wedding ring. That's what it is, you know. So it's interesting, and it's interesting to see that the same tool, tarot, can be used to hit both sides of that.
Oh, yeah. I've had a student just this past year. She asked me a question about that. She, before she took the class or signed up for it, she wanted to know how I felt about her using tarot. And I said, I'm fine with that, because I know that each medium, each person, we're all wired differently. And if that works for you, then that's great, because you've already opened up a lot of your clairvoyance. So she wound up taking the class, and she's doing excellent work. But it really, really can open up your creativity into spirit art, you know, any kind of creative modality that you do. It will help ground you. It will help. And a lot of the students I see, they just need one card for a jumping off point.
Yeah.
You know, they might see the Emperor and feel like, okay, I have your dad here, because that's what that symbol means to them. So it's not just a psychic tool.
No.
It can open up so many impressions.
Well, and It's interesting, because it's literally I was telling my son the other day, my son just turned 9, He goes to magic camp, stuff like that. So he is well versed in cards. He will whoop somebody down in spades. I'll tell you that.
And there's such a connection.
Exactly. Right? That's what I told him. I was like, because he was like, "What are?" He was here while I was making our artwork for the post and everything else. And I was explaining to him how to make a WordPress post, and this is how you make the artwork and everything else, because he's a content creator, and he's learning all these things. So yeah, as we were talking about it, I was introducing him to the concept of tarot and what its roots are and what it's about and its connection to playing cards. And once again, there's the discipline of numerology tied into it. There is all kinds of esoteric storytelling having to do with history. There is the birth, death, resurrection of Jesus inside of there. There, like, it's wild. It is wild, the stuff that is contained inside of tarot, Julie. And once again, the fact that it can be used as a tool. Now, let's start getting into and cracking the nut a little bit on the spiritual side of things. Because one of the things that you specifically do is seance work. And by that is connecting with people's loved ones. This is something, once again, like I said at the beginning of things, that people like Harry Houdini spent the latter part of his life chasing down people who took advantage of folks in horrible ways. And I do a pretty good job of researching my guests and things like that to find out their credos and whether or not they are reputable people in what they say they do. And you are fantastic, Julie. Now, one of the things I will always say, I have no problem with anybody that I will be around Ouija boards, things like that. I'm not going to have one in my house.
I agree with you. I'm very open. I know people use them all the time.
Absolutely.
I've never been attracted to use one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just have not. I don't know why. I've table tipped. That's okay. But I don't use it to get letters to spell anybody.
Yeah. I use a pendulum. I do pendulum work, all kinds of things. But I almost made Curious Realm answer boards. And then I was like, I can't. I cannot ring the bell of caution to people in episodes when I'm trying to demystify things. And once again, you know, give people the most educated and balanced view on this, because there's both sides of a coin, both sides of a situation. And the fact is that, yes, there are fantastic people out there who are able to contact the other side, who are able to get results in that kind of way. We've had them on the show before. I've had readings done that Vinnie Todd Tolman was one. Like, I wept, Julie, when he finished with me at the International Association of Near-Death Studies Conference, and he saw my grandfather with me. Like, he released something I'd been holding on to since seventh grade. Man, it was so cathartic and beautiful. I'm about to weep right now talking about it.
Very healing.
And that's just it. There are talented, beautiful people in this realm. And unfortunately, the charlatans give the good ones bad names. Much like any good research out there, things like that. How do you begin to use tarot to tune in that kind of way? How do you use tarot when it comes to connection with the spiritual side in that kind of way, Julie?
Well, it's kind of just, I will have them around. Sometimes just the shuffling, the act of shuffling the cards, it gets my, it gets me out of my conscious mind and into my zone where I need to be. Or you can take a card. Sometimes I myself might pull a few cards. And I know it's nice for your clients, because a lot of them need something to look at, need something to focus on, because some of them are afraid or maybe uncomfortable. if they're in the room, you know, with you, it might be their first reading, and it gives them something to focus on. And I interact with them. If I have someone in person, I will actually shuffle and I'll let them cut the deck. I'll offer the fan and they can pull a couple cards because it gives them a little empowerment too.
Sure.
With the, you know, that, okay, they were drawn to the card they needed to see. So there's so many things that can help open. So those are a couple of the things I do. And I want to say too, that color in cards is a big thing too.
Mm.
The colors, the reds, the blues, the yellow, because all colors, the rays, they can have, they all have different vibration.
Yep.
Like red is a powerful color. So there's just so many aspects of the tarot that you can use and just focus on. But they're also good to practice, like if you lay the cards down, and you can also do this with regular playing cards, but try to feel the energy of the cards. Mm. Some cards, as we know, feel more chaotic, not peaceful, like the Tower card or the Three of Swords, the breakup. They'll feel different. So if you will run your hand over them, you will feel difference in the energy of the cards. So that's another way you can learn to feel energy that can help you with psychometry. If you're wanting to learn psychometry.
Sure. Sure. Which is a kind of like pendulum work, but using your hands to feel the energetic difference. That's highly demonstrated at Psy Games. They do quite a bit of that, where it's hand dowsing, basically. Yeah. Find the puck with the gold coin inside of it, stuff like that. And it's wild. I was one of the commentators during last year's inaugural Psy Games during the dowsing competition. So I got to see quite a bit of psychometry in real-time play in that kind of way. And it's fascinating because psychometry is somewhat used also in remote viewing. Because the first thing you do with remote viewing, at least in controlled remote viewing and things, is your ideogram. The flurry of your pen till it stops. And then from there, you're feeling and you're touching the ideogram, and from that synesthetic touch, you start drawing things, you start getting impressions. So that idea of touch and feeling things, and that idea of color vibration, is hugely important with connection in that kind of way.
Yes, and well, you mentioned like getting an impression, so. Say someone just got an impression of a rose, a medium, okay, and they're reading somebody, and there's lots of roses in the tarot cards, lots of flowers, which can symbolize abundance. But so say that your impression was a rose, and so the rose itself is the impression, but what does it mean to you? What have you experienced in previous readings? What's in your reference library over a rose? So most of the time for me, it's a name.
Mm.
Because if I see a rose, I'm 9 times out of 10, it's for someone's name. But it can also mean love, you know, because a single rose means love as well. So it's what it means to you with the references that you've already created.
Sure. Sure.
So getting those impressions are so important. And the way you get them is just to play with the cards, study them. You don't have to seriously make a big fuss over it or stress yourself out to learn every single card. I mean, it's great to do that. And I did that myself. I wanted to know what the author meant. You know, what was his tradition, traditional meaning. But then you take it from there on your own with your own intuition.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I'll hold it up for you right now, folks. And inside my, in the bottom of my deck box is actually the manual that tells you what all the meanings are. Like it's right there, but that's a tarot card deck, folks. It's a good two fingers thick, you know. There is once again a good three meanings for each card, and those meanings vary and change in subtlety depending on where they are in a reading, in a spread, things like that, and depending on what your use is in that kind of way, you know, because the meaning may be totally different in a spiritual reading like what you're doing or a spirit reading, Julie, than it would be a reading about like what do I need to do about my forlorn love? You know, that rose may mean something totally different in that spiritual reading than it does in a reading about love or in a reading about, you know, what's going to happen with my new job, you know, that kind of stuff where you're looking for an answer for something.
Yes. So. And I love that there's just so much numerology because it shows us like from 2 to 10, all the changes, those incremental changes. And Pythagoras gave us numerology and the music notes and all of that. And he was an ascended master, Master Kutumi, a Hindu master in a previous life. So that information that came through is just, if you can learn even the numerology and the feel of the numbers, you can also use that in your readings. A lot of times we see numbers and we don't know, am I seeing it for a month? Am I seeing it because they have two kids? Am I seeing it? You know, you have to figure that out. But
yeah,
the more you tune into the numbers, it starts to click.
Yeah. Now, once again, a big part of this show, Julie, is breaking things down, demystifying things. Here is a card that I think brings about a lot of consternation with people who do not understand tarot. I'll bring it up on screen. We've got the Death card here. And there are some immediate connotations that people go to with the Death card. But it's one of my favorite tarot cards because of its actual meaning and the whole concept of just, you have a chance to reset yourself, to be reborn. You have a chance to catharsize and learn from a possible mistake, something like that. But when you talk about symbology, man, the symbology in this card is so entirely rich. And you know, for those of you that are watching right now instead of just listening, if you look on your screen, I'm highlighting a little part right there. Which is, interestingly enough, the scene from the Towers card in the background of the Death card. So like it's, you know, like there's that whole esoteric school, the idea of one card relates to another card later on in the deck. And also just the deep symbology of, look, you've got the setting sun, which means like something's about to change, but it could also be the rising sun of a horizon where you're moving to that and to new birth and change. And then there's the symbology there of 13, Friday the 13th, the day that the Templars died and the Rosicrucian rose, like literally the Rosicrucian rose, as well as the Pope pleading because, you know, he was cursed by Jacques de Molay. So it's just rife in symbolism and yet at the same time so completely misunderstood by those outside of the esoteric system that it represents, truly.
Yes, and it's scary. I do have to say, most of the time, yes, it's transformation. I have had it be literal twice.
Sure, absolutely.
You know? But there were a lot of changes and transformation before, but so
yeah.
But, if you look at the way the soul, the knight is sitting up so straight and steady on that horse, and yes, it's a white horse.
Yep.
So white is purity. You know, I mean, there's a lot of good things. He's holding up his staff, holding it up. It's not like sideways or anything. So yeah, it is a good card. It's a card of transformation, change, and good opportunity, new opportunities.
Well, and I was going to say, and when it comes to a spirit reading, when it comes to specifically what you do with a mediumship reading in that kind of way, what does the representation mean at that point? And how do you normally run a reading in that kind of way? Let's say we've got about 20 minutes left. Let's spend the next few minutes kind of walk us through a typical tarot reading with a client when they come in to connect with a loved one, and you're going to use tarot to do so.
Well, I first of all explain how I do my readings. I introduce myself and I ask them not to feed the medium, just say yes or no, or I don't know, you know, don't give me any information because people like to talk, you know, they're excited. They want to tell their story. But so I have to gently just explain that we want to give spirit a chance to come in first, so that we will know and feel good about it. So I will just pull one or two cards in the beginning of a reading, and just like a little jumping point. I don't always do it. Sometimes I'll wait till later if I know that they want cards, because sometimes they'll say, well, will you do the cards too afterwards? So it just depends on what the client wants.
Okay.
I'll go ahead with the reading, but if I've pulled a couple cards first, I already know if they are, like I said, if it's sometimes you will get the Empress. So I know that that's someone like a mother, a grandmother, someone very nurturing, you know, that they are missing. So you can use that symbolism, but sometimes you just tune into what you get, and everything starts coming in clairvoyantly. I'm very clairvoyant and clairaudient, and clairsentient, but I like to at least use 2 to 3 of the clairs when I'm doing a reading, because I feel like you get a richer experience, and it's easier then because I'll understand the information better.
Sure.
So that's one thing I try to teach my students to, you know, we all have our most powerful clairs, but I'll have them practice using the ones they feel are the weakest to help build them up. So that's exercises that we do. But as far as the readings go, a lot of times they want me to pull a few cards for, you know, what's coming up or just general. And then we'll do that. And people like them. People are very attracted to the cards. I feel like, and it does give them focus too. It helps them feel, you know, like almost like a double validation. And a lot of times if we do the cards afterwards, a lot of what I said was kind of validated by the cards that come up. So it's a reassurance to some people. But and how I do my readings, I go for, I say, up to 40 minutes. Because for me, when I'm doing a reading, the information comes in fast. I sometimes just get flooded with stuff. So I don't want to be a therapist about it. I want to give the information I'm getting. We talk about it. Afterwards, they can say yes or no. And no's are okay, too, because if you get a no, then you just go back and redirect. Maybe your impression wasn't strong enough.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I interpreted it wrong, you know. So I think it's a wonderful, just a wonderful practice,
and
because People need to know there's more to us here in the physical and on the other side.
That brings up a really good point, which is, in a remote viewing session, you've typically got a monitor. You've got somebody who is there taking notes. You've got somebody who's there like, you seem a little lost on this part. A while ago, you said you smelled salt water. Let's go back and revisit that. Do you recommend that people like actively take a couple of notes, things like that, as a session goes on with you so that kind of stuff can be hammered back out? Like, hey, you mentioned something and it made me think of my Uncle Chester. And you can drill down, you can dive deeper into something in that kind of way.
Yes, I always encourage note taking. I used to record them, but living in Chicago, there's a lot of crime and a lot of things that could come up or evidence. So I stopped doing recordings.
Yeah.
And also because if they don't download their recording, which a lot of times they forget to or they don't know, then it disappears. And then they're wanting their recording and it's gone.
So then you end up like me and you end up with terabytes of recorded audio and video because, that person may come back for that recording 3 years later. Like the amount of stuff I just went through, I just went through my client drive all of today. And it was like, my God, the amount of stuff I have from 10 years ago, just in case that person calls me back for something. But we did have a great question come in from Janice Connolly, actually, which was, how do you go about choosing a deck? I've had people ask me this. I've given that. Mine came to me, I'm familiar with the Rider-Waite. My brother was the one who introduced me to that. I had friends that use it, all kinds of things. I like that because of its tradition of use, for its longevity of use. And I love the uber detailed artwork in it. But I also love my Thoth deck, stuff like that, that my brother gave me a few Christmases ago. Things like that. And there are fairy decks. There's all kinds of stuff out there, Julie. How do you go about recommending one of your students choose a deck when it comes time for a student and they're like, okay, I'm in my mediumship journey. I would like to make tarot one of the tools in my tool chest. How do you recommend somebody choose?
Well, I always say the law of attraction is very powerful. If it's a colorful deck, and also if they can, to go to a shop where they can actually open the deck or they'll have a sample to feel it, because I buy decks all the time, but I can tell you there's so many I've not even opened. I've bought them, but then once I got them, I was just like not inclined to use them. So, but I really need to feel that energetic connection. And I'm very visual. It has to be like, I am very traditional too with the Rider-Waite, but there are a couple other decks that, I liked. I like some Radley Valentine decks. I'm some of his angel decks I've used in the past. And basically if it's a tarot deck, a tarot deck has structure.
Yeah.
So it's always going to be the same structure. And I'm attracted to color. I'm a visual person. So I usually go with a colorful deck, but I like to feel it. You'll feel it. Just like I said, if you can open the deck and just feel over the cards, or sometimes just when you hold it in your hands, you'll know.
For me, the manipulation is a big part of it. For me, I'm the same, even with my gear here. It's one of those none of this was bought without being able to touch the knobs and the buttons. I've got to be, it's one of those. And even all of my guitars, I choose guitars, even crystals, the exact same way. I will sit in a crystal shop for 20-30 minutes in a tray of quartz until I find the one that resonates with me and says, like, oh no, we need to be friends for a while. And if it says I need to give it to a friend, I'll give it to a friend. I've given away I don't know how many tarot decks in my life, all kinds of stuff. But my guitars are the same way. I can pick up three of the exact same guitar, and there is one that will speak to me. And every once in a while, it's one where whenever it speaks to me, like, it's coming home with me. Like, there's no question. There's no doubt. I don't care if the cell phone bill has to wait a week. Like, it's coming home with me because it spoke to me in that kind of way, you know. And
I love that that just goes into play because the numerology, the musical notes, the vibration. So many spiritual people play guitars or they play an instrument.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it really is understanding that connection. Understanding that connection to what moves you, I think, is more paramount than anything, Julie. Because that's what's going to connect you with the symbology of tarot to begin with. I know numerous people that tarot does nothing. They are mediums. They do all kinds of tarot does nothing for them. They have no interest. It's much like for many of them.
Excuse me.
No worries. Bless you. Much like controlled remote viewing for many mediums. I think tarot for many mediums is too rigid of a system.
Yes.
They see the lays, they see the 28 different patterns that you can use for different types of readings and, you know, angelic cards and all kinds of stuff. And it's one of those, can we just get back to being a medium? Because once again the three meanings per card and then the nuances between them is too much of a rigid system to be able to, I guess, translate in that kind of way.
Yeah, I feel like it all comes down to the law of attraction. It was something that I had on my bucket list that I wanted to do. And as a child, we always play cards, you know, every holiday, everybody, you know, around the dining room table and everybody's playing cards. But I think that that was just ingrained in me, but also past lives. If you've done it in a past life, you know, the oracles of Delphi, I mean, in the ancient mystery schools, all of this was used.
Yep.
So a lot of it can be cellular memory.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And especially when it comes to that understanding of your place within it, I think is a huge part of cellular memory, Julie.
Yes.
Much like anybody that is naturally adept at swimming or naturally adept at swinging a tennis racket, as long as you have ability of and faculty of limbs and other things to be able to swing a tennis racket and move across the court in some fashion, you can play tennis. There are people who are amazingly adept at it from the get. And people ask me that, you know, like, oh, I can't remote view. And I'm like, I beg to differ. I'm no psychic. I'm no medium. I am not a clairvoyant in any kind of way like that, but I can remote view. And my brother took a class for 2-3 afternoons and did amazingly well. And it's interesting, and it goes beyond beginner's luck. You know, it's the fact that we all have this faculty to be connected in that kind of way. Some of us are more adept at it than others, and some of us will always be more adept. But it can all be trained. It can all be learned. It can all be nuanced. It can all be built upon in these systems. And yes, you can use one system to help trigger another, to help bolster another. Like you're saying to, and the other remote viewers I know who have said that they use tarot to begin their session, to literally just align their brain waves to, this is my moment of purpose now. You know, that's when I do this is what I'm going to be doing next. you know, and it really does prepare your brain in that kind of way. Your brain starts shifting gears as soon as it starts hearing the shuffle of cards and feeling the shuffle.
Yes, exactly. And even just one card, you can pull one card and do amazing fast readings for people. You can find out so much just by feeling into that person, feeling into the card. And people will say, well, how'd you get all that information about me from that one card in just a minute or two? But you can, if you practice, and it's like psychic sit-ups, and you just, it's a language. And it's like, once you understand the language,
yeah,
you're going to pick it up faster.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a difference, especially between fluently speaking a language and getting your way through it. And that takes time, and it takes time to learn to not translate things in real time in your head, to just flow with it and go with it, you know. And those things are muscles, and the more you do it, the better you are at it, the better you get at it, you know. So once again, all of this stuff can be learned, trained. How can people, in the last couple minutes here, Julie, how can people get a hold of you for not only training, because you do training in mediumship, you do training in tarot, all that kind of stuff, but how can they get a hold of you for personal readings? How can they get a hold of you for everything that you do?
Well, I have a website, Julie Adriani Spirit Medium, and I'm just renewing it now. I'm updating it. I will be adding some classes on there.
Great.
That's it. And there's a little form that will just click on it if you want a reading, and it comes directly to my email. But I'm also on Facebook, very active on Facebook or social media. So I'm always posting events or what's coming up next. So you could always message me that way. And I'm on YouTube.
Okay.
And let's see. And I want to highlight the book.
Oh.
So I also have a Facebook page for the book that I just wrote.
Awesome.
A couple months ago. And it's just about my journey into the mediumship. Because so many people, you know, they go through a lot. It's a tough journey when you're seeing things. I mean, everything a medium sees, feels, and goes through, you can be considered to be all kind of mental health diagnoses after that, right?
Yeah.
So it's a struggle, it's a journey, and it takes a long time to be able to be comfortable and understand what's going on. So I wrote the book to try to help others, and so they could see what I've went through. Maybe it'll help somebody. And also there's some documented work that's in the back of the book about mediumship work and seances. And my specialty is red light and materialization seances as well. So, and I feel like all of this is just a natural progression of my mediumship. I never set out to be physical medium or, you know, or a mental medium. It just all happened. But I feel like as you keep working, as you keep doing, it's a natural progression.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I want to thank you for your open and honest candor and conversation tonight. It's a very, very thick and nebulous topic. I would love to have you on again. Before we let you go, truly, real quick, because we started with caveats. We started talking about charlatans in this industry, things like that. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend for people out there that do want to contact a medium? And in the world of seance, folks, like, there's a seance society here in Austin that I've considered having on the show, all kinds of stuff. The world of seance has rapidly come back into the headlights of paranormal, Julie. And it's one of those much like bringing any psychic or medium to a paranormal investigation. It's one of those you need to be careful how you go about asking questions to things on the other side. You are opening windows. You're leaving windows open. All kinds of things. That's just it. And that's what I do. I don't want people to go to charlatans. I want them to be able to spot them. I want them to be able to know immediately, like, hey, somebody, you go into a place to get a reading, and somebody says these three things, just walk out the door, man. So what do people need to look out for when it comes to a medium, when it comes to a seance session to connect with a loved one, Julie?
Well, okay. So the kind of mediumship, the physical mediumship I do, you don't always connect to loved ones. Sure. There might be other spirits coming in. But there's all different types of seances as well, though. There's some seances where you sit around a table with a candle, and and that might be the focus. You want to connect with a loved one.
Sure.
So that's not how my physical mediumship works. I work with an open cabinet. That's my cabinet behind me. Curtains are opened, and I'm a transfiguration medium. So your loved one might transfigure, which means my face will change to look like one of your loved ones.
Oh, wow.
Or a recognizable figure of that people recognize, or an ascended master, or an ET. So I'm also an experiencer, personal, and I have a lot of cosmic or ET guides come through and transfigure. So there's a lot when you go into the seance. So
yeah,
we'll have to come again.
It's a whole episode, but it's one of those I like to let people know. How they can protect themselves, how they can keep themselves from falling victim to somebody trying to take advantage of them.
Yes, even with mental mediumship, you don't want to have someone ask you to come back. Well, you're going to have to come back in 2 weeks, and it's going to cost this much. No, you shouldn't have more than one, maybe two mediumship readings a year. In my opinion, one is good. Beautiful. I have clients that are like on a yearly thing, or sometimes they'll skip a year, Now, if it's psychic and they're going through a problem, that's different, then maybe, or switch them over to life coaching. But mediumship reading, you should not have them very often. No one should be telling you it's going to cost this much money, buy this color candle, all that gimmick stuff. No.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly, Julie. And that's what I want people to caveat emptor and beware, because those things are out there, and the field is rife with them. Probably about every third out of four shops that you walk into are like that. Kind of way.
Yeah. Or even threatening. Sometimes they'll threaten you. I've been threatened myself years ago. If you don't do this, something bad's going to happen to you.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. What is it? I didn't realize that I'd received a chain letter on my way in the door. You better send this money to somebody in the name of St. Jude, or else, because St. Jude, he's after people, the patron saint of the hopeless cause. That's just it. That's just it. And it's one of those, if you walk in, it feels funky, walk right out. If they immediately start at, like you said, the first thing you tell people is, please do not prompt me. Please, don't just sit back and listen. And the three times that I have had a full on medium, I will always say, if you are out there listening, Ken Newton, there was one, Rocky Paul Morneau. I get chills thinking about Rocky. Rocky would call me sometimes, and Ken called me one day. Ken was not a spiritual guy, Julie, not one bit in that kind of way. He'd seen things, stuff like that, but he's a pretty logical dude. And when he called me up and he was like, I've got this guy who's a medium and he needs to talk to you. And I need you to just be quiet and listen. And when he's done, he'll tell you he's done and you can talk. Yes. But I know you're going to want to ask questions. Don't ask questions. Just shut up and listen. And Rocky talked for an hour and a half, man, and told me personal things about my life that nobody knew. Like, no, nobody knew. Nobody knew. Things from the seminary, all kinds of stuff. Like, ain't nobody know this, except for me and my dead spiritual director. You know, things like that.
When you get someone like that.
Yeah. And we had a beautiful relationship for a long time. He would call me every couple few months like that, where he would just call with information that he had to tell me. And it's amazing how many of those things have come to pan out over time. How many of those things have come to fruition over time, exactly like Rocky said they would. You know, and it's beautiful and it's amazing. But that's just it. It was an unprompted situation. And if they're digging for information, if they're looking for data, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Just walk away.
They should never ask questions. The medium should never ask questions, you know, to their client.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's.
Yeah. Well, Julie, once again, I want to thank you for your honest, your open conversation tonight. It's truly been amazing. I've been looking forward to it since we booked it with Michelle. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Yes,
for the connection. I cannot wait to have you on again and again. Next time we will definitely have you on to talk just about seances and what that world is and help demystify that a little bit for the folks out there. But before we let you go one last time, let everyone know where they can go to get their copy of Messages from the Beyond, One Woman's Journey into Physical Mediumship.
Right now, it's available on Amazon. There's a few metaphysical stores that are that have the book. Lily Dale, The Sacred Grounds, is going to carry the book for me also. But I know it's easy on Amazon. It's easy to click and get it the next day. So,
absolutely. Well, Julie, I want to thank you so much for your time tonight. I want to thank you so much once again for the great conversation. Feel free to stay tuned through the rest of the episode. We'll be in touch with links and all that kind of good stuff.
All right. Thank you so much. It was wonderful.
All right.
Thank you.
Same
Bye,
here.
Everyone.
Take care. Man, what an amazing conversation, folks. Make sure to stop on by her website. Make sure to stop on by. Get your copy of the book. When we come back from this quick commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend Ryan Edwards, cryptozoologist. We will be talking about the world of AI and its impact on para investigation all the way around, from UFO UAP to cryptozoology to paranormal and parapsychological, what these things do, what these things can do, how to spot fakes, and why this needs to be a huge part of the conversation right now. We will get into that and more with our good friend Ryan Edwards right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying with us. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by True Hemp Science today. True Hemp Science uses a spigeric process by which every part of the hemp plant is used. That's every part, folks. Seeds, stems, buds, leaves, fibers, stems, all of it, roots, all of it is used, combusted, and reused, and that process followed time and time again until nothing remains but an amazing spigeric product, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Find the product that works right for you. I have been using them for at least a good 6 years now, and I attest to True Hemp Science. Their stuff is absolutely amazing. Their terpene profiles are dead on, and they are one of the only places online where you will find full-on terpene profiles for your product, knowing that it is actual CBD being used, folks. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get free edibles on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is our good friend Ryan Edwards. He is the author of so many books. He is a cryptozoologist, researcher, and one of the people that we come to discuss issues facing our various communities, whether they be cryptozoology, in your case, Ryan, paranormal, UFO, UAP. All of these communities have various issues set before them and various things that they are dealing with regarding everything from belief to investigation to data, evidence, all kinds of things. So thank you so much for always coming on the show, and welcome back, bud.
Of course, it's good to be on you, bud.
Absolutely, man. And our topic tonight, I love the fact that, A, you brought up the topic tonight so frequently. It's the fact I got to rack my brain for a topic in some way. But you brought up one that is truly nail on the head, right where everybody needs to be talking and addressing, and that is the world of AI and its uses in our community of research, specifically when it comes to like people that are calling themselves researchers, people that are out there in the field doing work, people who are investigating in the background, on the sidelines, things like that, being educated in the world of AI, what it can do, how to spot it, I think is one of the most paramount things in all of these fields right now, Ryan. So,
no, of course. Like, how I see it with AI, but it being such a modern thing, like, it's a new kid on the block when it comes to collecting evidence and things like that right now. And people, especially researchers, need to look at what's the separation between AI and hoaxes. Because I'm realizing, especially when it comes to cryptozoology, AI is getting used in this field, but for more nefarious purposes, I would say. Like, there's so many AI videos of Sasquatch, Dogman, Skinwalkers, all these cryptids, and even paranormal events. Like, I even have seen AI UFO videos and
absolutely,
AI ghost videos. And people are putting these off as almost as evidence and as data. And I say for researchers like myself and others, we need to look at this and like, okay, this is the new Photoshop of our generation, I say. Like, that's something I talk to people, especially young people, like, I haven't heard the word Photoshop in decades, I feel. Like, people don't Photoshop, it's now AI. Yeah. So, what can we do from back in the 90s and 2000s, people would say, oh, someone photoshopped a Bigfoot photo.
Yep.
Now people can use AI to make a Bigfoot photo. So how do we separate the real stuff from stuff that's fake? And that's what's kind of hard for us right now.
Yeah. No, precisely, man. And as a 50-year-old, it's very interesting. I love having you on because, A, I see you very much as a lot of the future of cryptozoology. Whenever I walk into rooms, whenever I walk into conferences, whenever I walk onto stage to speak, and people go, oh my God, this guy, what a fresh, amazing concept. What a great way to look at the future of this stuff. I have to remind them that I am 50, man. Like, I'm on your coattails. It's no different than whenever I would walk into a Knights of Columbus meeting and like people would be buying me beer, like, oh, keep this young buck around. It's like, young buck, I'm 50. Yeah. I am not the demographic that you should be courting to onboard into this. You should be courting somebody 25 years younger than me to onboard into this. You know, people like you, people your age, because otherwise, where's it going 10 years from now? Right back to retirement. You know, yeah. and that's the thing. And as somebody that's 50, A, I love your fresh perspective on this. B, I remember when Photoshop came around. I have been a Photoshop editor since before it was part of Adobe in that kind of way, since before Adobe Suite has existed. I've been using Premiere since before it was part of Adobe. And wow. Boris effects since before it was part of Adobe Suite and just built into Adobe Premiere for video editing. So I remember I learned to edit video deck to deck in VHS and Super VHS and digital formats on tape. So you learned to shoot in a different way. You learned to treat your footage in a different way from the beginning. You learn to walk into a shoot with a plan of shooting, not shooting any way you wanted because you could edit it any way you wanted after in a non-deprecated way using a digital file. You know, you had very specialized ways that you treated things. And a lot of people, especially art-wise and education-wise, Ryan, were worried with specialized fields like graphic design, specifically font design, stuff like that, that Adobe was going to destroy that art form. Same way as people thought that photographs were going to destroy painting.
Yeah.
Back in the late 1800s.
You see the same pattern popping up throughout time. Like look at nowadays with AI. People say with AI creation, artists aren't necessary anymore, almost. Like, the computers would do all of it for them. And you see that same pattern of people thinking the new thing on the block is going to take out everyone else before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, like, even as a musician, man, like, I will gladly, I just wrote and used AI to help create a ton of remixes of my music into the world of dubstep. And I know quite a few techniques for dubstep, things like that, as far as electronic music creation. What I don't want to have to do is go back and recreate every single track of my stuff. So I take a stem track, I throw it in, I have AI regenerated into a different BPM with this type of sound and craft it exactly how I want it and have it spit it out. And then I reassemble those tracks. You know, no different than if I went back to my raw track inside of the synthesizer and said, change this voice from a sawtooth wave to a square wave.
Wow.
You know, no different. I'm using it as a tool in that way. I'm not using it to create everything from the ground up. There's two different uses there.
And that's the thing, too, is I always tell people about, like, with AI and stuff like that, and anything digital, it's using it as a tool, not as just a creation. Like, when you go in and say, like, with research, there's been times when I talk to researchers, I'm like, oh, well, we have AI do help us with our research. I'm like, okay, how much is it helping and how much are you having it do it for you? Like, with data collection and things like that, like, I witnessed testimony for Sasquatch and I witnessed testimony for cryptids. If you put in the data and you let AI generate, that's perfectly okay. But if you put in okay, let me just have AI generate the signs and all this stuff, then that's faulty data.
Yes.
And how AI should be done is used as a tool for creation, not just the thing to create all everything by itself, because the human mind is still necessary. And it's still a critical thinking skills are necessary for that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, precisely. A prime example, like Curious Realm, Curious Research, we use AI. We use AI to curate data and to rapidly search data. So prime example would be the documents that we curated for the Department of War UFO pursue files. We had AI comb through that and make a PDF of all of the videos.
Yeah.
With a hot link to all those videos. So I had AI do that heavy lifting for me. That's different. It's using it as a tool in that way. And same thing with research. I have literally used my Sci Summary as one of my favorite tools to use. And if you are a researcher out there searching specific things, using it, it is specifically a document tool where it doesn't search the whole internet. It only searches specifically the documents that you give it or the links that you give it. So at that point, it's like, look at these 25 scholarly articles on liver disease and summarize them into, you know, 1,000 words and 10 bullet points.
And that's the thing too. It's like you've only created the list of data to look at. So if you use like ChatGPT or something like that,
you'll
use the whole internet to look at data, not just what you selected. And now you know, okay, this is the data I want. That is correct. That has been scholarly article that we know is correct data.
Yeah.
Now let's analyze this. Now let's not analyze everything. Let's analyze what we have here. Like, going out to maybe the bathwater type thing. It's like, let's not analyze the bathwater. Let's just analyze what's in the bathwater. Like, you gotta look at not everything. You gotta look at a small picture of data. And that's something with science is compartmentalization. Making little stuff into smaller stuff.
Yep.
And that's what you gotta do with data. And using AI to do that is perfectly okay. But once you see how much, like, I've seen hoaxes and fakery goes on when it comes to AI, that's the stuff that researchers like myself need to discuss.
And absolutely.
How much of this is altering our perception of like video and audio? Cause I'll be honest with you, Chris, like with me, I don't look at video or audio or anything like that because how much fakery happens and how much misconceptions happen with it. Like people are like, oh, here's a video of Sasquatch. Here's a video of a Dogman. I'm like, I'm going to look at it, but I'm not going to create an opinion on it because how much AI and how much hoaxes have kind of muddied the waters over the past couple of years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the on screen, for those out there who are just listening, we were talking about that before the show, how many people just listen as opposed to watching. But on screen right now is an AI image, folks. This was making the rounds. I presented this at Symposium of the Strange in my investigating paranormal data. And I think that's a huge part of it to begin with, Ryan, is we have to be willing ourselves as investigators. So whether you're out up against a tree looking for Sasquatch, doesn't matter. We have to be willing to put a lens on ourselves. We have to be willing to put a mirror up to ourselves, and we have to understand every single time. And I will give this prime example. The prime example of an investigator not doing their job was the Roman Catholic exorcist that was just dismissed from his duties as an exorcist. Why, you may ask, folks? Not because of some cover-up, but because the exorcist, whose job it is to demoniacally research every single case on a case-by-case basis to find out if it is demonology or not and demoniacally connected, literally publicly said, all UFOs are demons. That is not investigation. That is a blanket statement. And when you say all UFOs are demons, that means you, as the demonologist, have now stopped investigating on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
So immediately remove him from the office of exorcist because he's no longer investigating demonology. Period. Period. Like, let's start there. And if you're going to do investigation, let's start with actual investigation, which happens on a case-by-case basis. So you've got to be willing to, even the church is like, you got to be willing to step back and put a lens on yourself and go, whoa, 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 wait a minute. No. You know? Go ahead.
That's something that happens a lot. Like, there's so many people that we talk to over the years, like, with Sasquatch. Oh, Sasquatch is an alien. Okay. Are they all aliens? Yeah, they're all aliens. Then let's break it down to case-by-case evidence. Or Dogman is a spirit, or Dogman is a demon. Okay. That is your opinion. That's your perspective. But let's break it down case-by-case, and let's see what data we can find to support that hypothesis. And so many people create hypotheses, but they never create a theory. That's one thing I always say. They always create ideas, always put ideas out there, but they never have the data, or they never do the backing up to support that hypothesis and create it into a proper theory using the methods of science. So you can put so many things out there in the world. You can put so many ideas out there, but you need to have the data to support it. And that's something, especially the paranormal and the 14 research, they really need to do that because so many people look at 14 research, cryptozoology, ufology, paranormal research, and think of it as pseudoscience. Think of it as just a bunch of people out in the woods looking for monsters and ghosts. We need to look at the sciences and support our ideas using not just blanket statements like all UFOs are demons.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and also understanding that psychology of the brain and how it works, and not just not just things like pareidolia, of course, are want to recognize something, but things like apophenia, the perception of patterns or connections between unrelated or random data, objects, and ideas in situations where no such patterns actually exist. Like, the idea of connecting these things as being the same or being connected, despite the fact that they aren't. And a prime example of that would be immediately, and this is very logical, folks, if you stop and think about it. Wouldn't you think that most firemen start fires? They're the first ones you see at a fire, right?
Yeah.
They're present in every fire you see. So that's the logic that apophenia follows.
Yeah.
Is the idea of, well, I see firemen at every single fire.
So they're the cause.
Hypothesis is they're the root cause.
Yeah.
You know?
Like what we say in science, correlation does not mean causation. Just because they correlate each other doesn't mean they cause it. Like one thing when it comes to cryptozoology, like so many people say, well, there's been signs between Sasquatch and orbs in the woods.
Yeah.
So Bigfoot are coming from orbs. I'm like, well, let's look at it. And just because two things are unknown doesn't mean they should be correlated. Like, how many times I've seen where people, they put UFOs, ghosts, and cryptids all in the same box. Because all of them are unknown, so they have to go with each other, correct?
They're all beyond normal.
Yeah, so they put them all in the same box, and that's not really how it should work. So let's break it down to, okay, with ufology, that's something that's astrological. Let's look at more stuff with the astrology and more stuff of, like, okay, astronomy, looking at the stars. Yeah. Paranormal research, like ghosts. Okay, let's look at electromagnetic fields. Let's look at those patterns.
Yeah.
Cryptozoology, we can break that down using biological sciences. So we just took three things out of one big box and put them in three separate boxes. And that's what we should do here is ourselves correlate just because something's unknown. They should all be correlated because they do not cause one another. And that happens even like with AI, like AI likes to correlate stuff.
That's right.
Just like the human mind. And it'll correlate all this data when it shouldn't be correlated.
Made to find a pattern. So you want to know, like, It is a conspiracy theory machine, literally, no different than your own head, folks. So you gotta beware of that. And you have to be aware of that. And more than anything, you have to be aware that there are numerous people out there, be it for sadly and horribly, Ryan. And there's two sides to this coin of person. One side is the person that wants to deceive, the person that is planning to deceive, likes to take advantage of people, likes to practical joke, likes to do whatever, that causes a stir and gives them their dopamine hit for jacking with somebody's day. And then there's the people who have the very deep-seated psychological need of connection through experience,
yeah,
through shared experience. And that's where I'll pop up a couple slides here from my presentation, because this is where perspective changes everything. this is the typical forced perspective. You see, and you have to be willing to understand that concept. The image that I just popped up on screen, folks, was a person pinching the top of the Eiffel Tower. It's an optical illusion in photography or video called forced perspective, where you are introducing something else into the image to make the perspective of something else off or askew. So by putting your hand closer than the Eiffel Tower, you can make your Eiffel Tower seem as large as your hand in that kind, yeah, of way. And that's the thing, is that if you are looking at if you're in a social media group and somebody just throws up, you know, and I'll throw up the video that I normally pop up. I could pop this up in any social media group. Right now there is a undulating colored ring with a black orb in the middle, very defined black orb, moving from the top left to the bottom right of the screen in a decent clip. You can see the undulations, you can see the colors, things like that. Now, if I just posted that up in a group and said, I recorded this in my backyard last night, zero frame of reference, zero data, once again, forced perspective, I have forced you into just looking at it and saying, I recorded this in my backyard. Mysterious, anomalous, strange. You'd see, yeah, a lot of people say, I've seen those too. Now, if I showed you that same video and said, I recorded this in my backyard last night in Cedar Park, Texas, looking to the southeast at 7:45 p.m. Central Standard Time, looking 35 degrees above the southeastern horizon on this date, you would very easily be able to decipher the fact that that is an unfocused image of the dog star Sirius.
Yeah.
A very common image in the night sky that, yes, does, even without being zoomed in. It's zoomed in, it's out of focus, and the whole reason it's moving is because it is on a tripod that is, it's in a telescope that's made to track the star, but it isn't tracking the star yet. That was the third star I was dialing in to get the calibration to track a celestial object. So what you're looking at is the actual motion of the Earth magnified by 8 times on that object. Yeah. So you're looking at the actual speed of the rotation of the Earth times 8, wow, which is what makes that object move across the screen. All, yeah, forced perspective, every bit of that. The question is, what is my motivation as the person posting that image?
Yeah, and that's one thing I always tell people too, like with perspective and perception. Your perception creates your reality. Like, how many, I freak people out all the time. Like, okay, when you're looking at someone, how many of those people exist at the same time? And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, I'm like, Chris, I'm looking at you from one angle. If someone was in your studio right now, they're looking at you from a totally different angle from me. Yes. Which Chris is real. And your perspective creates a reality. And when it comes to people that have done, like, hoaxes and things like that, like what you said, like, there are people that, like, I'll give an example, a researcher named Ivan Marks. He was a Bigfoot researcher from the 70s. And he was well known for his Bigfoot prints in Bosberg, Washington, the Cripplefoot footprints.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, he couldn't find any more evidence. So he actually started faking videos and footprints, because some people are so ravenous for that data. They're so ravenous for that proof that these animals exist, that these things that my lifelong dream has come true, that they're willing to fake evidence. And that's kind of sad, because it's that psychological effect of some people put their whole lives into this field. And
yeah,
they put their whole, right, they put their livelihoods on this. And when you do that, it becomes no longer research, and it becomes a livelihood. It becomes almost a cult of personality to an extent.
Absolutely.
And that's one thing I tell people when it comes to researching like cryptozoology and the full team. Like, this is a really kind of a weird field, because you have so many different perspectives, so many different psychological aspects going on. And a lot of people like to put the whole personality into this. And
that's it.
When you do that, it changes this from research to trying to prove you're right. And that's not what this is about. It's about trying to find the data, trying to find evidence for these things existing, and not trying to prove that you, what I saw when I was six in the woods exists now because I saw, I found a picture of Bigfoot. No, it's about, okay, you saw something when you were six. Let's use that data. Let's look at more data and see what we can prove from there.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And once again, it's hard for a lot of people, Ryan, because A, of the want of experience, B, the want of confirmation of belief. And when you marry those things together, it can be very, very hard for cognitive dissonance not to occur. It can be very, very hard for the person to not want to extrapolate, or to not want to accept extrapolation as a part of their reality. And like, I saw this in real time recently. I've told this story a couple times as of recent. I'll tell it again right now. My recent trip to Vegas, and you know, most people who know me, most people know I partake a little bit, Ryan, whenever I'm in a legal state, you know. So I normally go by the dispensary before I head to my hotel, things like that. Never know if I'm going to get to leave property. Stuff like that. So on my way there to EDC, Electric Daisy Carnival weekend. So very, very busy streets. Took like 45 minutes to get from the hotel to the dispensary from the airport to the dispensary to my hotel. So I had an extrapolated amount of time to talk with this guy. And it was right after the initial government disclosure files hit the internet, like 2 days after. He immediately starts into that. So I'm swimming in familiar waters. I'm like, all right, let's have this conversation. So we're having it. We're talking about it. And David Wilcock had recently killed himself.
Yes.
And he starts talking about cosmic disclosure and how it changed his life. And the truths behind cosmic disclosure and the 20 and back program. Like, well, you know, horrible realities with David Wilcock, you know, I don't think he was killed. He, even his family, even his best friend of his whole life said he took his own life, that he'd been struggling with these things for decades, for years, for just about his whole life. And then I started laying out the last 5 years of financial woe and why you haven't seen David on things, and the truth behind Corey Good and the show Cosmic Disclosure and the lawsuits between him and Gaia, for them using his intellectual property, because he said he created the blue avian aliens, not that they existed. And that he created them as his meditation guides. So nobody else has seen them. They don't exist.
Yeah.
Everything else was fiction. So I literally got to watch the edifice and shoring up of this person's belief over the last 10 years of their life, watching these things and having moments of revelation in their life and stuff like that, come to a confrontational head when they found out that the person that they had been listening to had avowed himself to be a liar. in his own court deposition that all of that was fiction and not real. And I was like, now that doesn't change your moment of revelation, my friend. It doesn't change your awakening. It doesn't change that, but it's something that you need to take into consideration.
It's the same thing. Like, one thing I've kind of thought about when it comes to like revelations and things like that, think of the whole drama right now going on a couple months ago with the passing Gimlin film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yep. Some people are saying, like, well, this new, I've not watched the film. I don't, not,
very few this, people have sure outside of that audience in Austin, Texas,
yeah.
Buddy.
Yeah. I was not in the audience, so I do not know if it was real or not. I have not watched the film, but so many people are saying, well, we have this evidence, so this means this video wasn't real. So they say, because of passing in the film isn't real, then nothing's real. And I'm like, well, no. Doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But like, I've had to talk to so many people, like, okay, worst case scenario, if Patty is proven to not be real, that doesn't mean Bigfoot isn't real. Like, yes, we've used a lot of data off of that. Yes, we've used a lot of body measurements and all that to perceive like what Sasquatch will look like biologically, but that doesn't mean the creature isn't real. Like, if you've seen Sasquatch, if you have eyewitness testimony, just because one video might be proven to be not real doesn't mean your experience wasn't real. And a lot of people, that's a revelation of like seeing a PG film for the first time. How many of our researcher friends have seen Legend of Bobby Creek or saw Paz and Gimlin in film, and that's what got them into this field?
That's right.
And for me, I'm like, if it is proven not to be real, I don't know. I do not have an opinion on it. Don't quote me on it. Like, it doesn't change your perspective. It doesn't change that you got into this field and there is actual evidence here. There have been videos. There have been audio recordings that we can look at. And also, stuff like that really makes me think of, like, what we should be doing is not really analyzing a lot of video, not be analyzing a lot of audio, but getting into the field itself.
That's it.
Like, look at people like Jane Goodall and researchers like that got into the woods. One of our good friends, Shelley Covington Montana, like, she is one of the researchers I really look up to in this field because she goes out in the woods for months at a time by herself. Like, and she is braver than any man I've ever met, I believe. And those are the researchers we need here, and people to actually go out and look for the data in the field itself. And talking to eyewitnesses is great, and that is a part of the data set.
Absolutely.
Nothing can be proven if we're not out there looking for these creatures and not looking at an AI image on a computer screen. Like, that's not going to get you really anywhere.
And not willing to call those things out when you see them, Ryan. And you know, here's a few little tips, folks. Things you can look for in photos, like inconsistent lighting and shadows, warped or repeated patterns, blurry edges, you know, mismatched resolutions or grains, impossible reflections. Like, here's an example right here where you can see that obviously the ladybug is pasted in. There is no shadow of the ladybug like there is for the butterfly.
Yeah.
You know, and it looks real enough, but when you start looking in, you can see jagged edges up around. Stuff like that. You can see where the leg disappears from not being able to grab the pixels, you know, that kind of thing. Go ahead.
And adding to that too, like, recently, what I've been getting a lot of, like, on my feed and people talking to me about is, like, a lot of these, like, videos of, like, animals. Like, clearly AI videos of animals. Like, one person showed me a video of, like, a bear putting a bear cub in through a car window. And I'm like, okay, let's not just break it down by pixel, like what, let's break it down by behavior.
Yeah.
Well, animals act like this. Animals don't act like this.
Yeah.
So what can we say? Like, okay, if that's so, so unrealistic, we know it's an AI video. They're like, well, prove it's an AI video. I'm like, well, just look at the behavioral aspects of how these animals are acting. You know, it's not real. Or I get so many videos of like someone seeing a Sasquatch walk across the field and like, well, I can see from the movement that that's not realistic. And looking at the behavior sets and looking at things like that and changing your perspective on it. And that's how one thing I look at with a lot of AI videos now is these animals or subjects that are in these videos, are they acting realistically? And yeah. If not, that's something that we should look at, and most likely it is AI or something fake, something hoaxed. Like, yeah. Almost like what you say right at your bottom, too perfect composition. The behavior is too perfect. Like, it's not realistic.
Even the fact of the capture of it is too perfect. There was one in a group the other day that I was like, I'm sorry, I will immediately tell you this is AI and fake. There is no fog between the lens and the subject. Yeah. There was fog entirely behind the critter in the woods, all kinds of stuff, but zero fog or vapor between in this perfectly composed, perfectly lit image. In an early morning foggy wood, you know, that's the perfect composition in that moment. And it's like, no, because I guess the fog just stopped in that 10-foot area.
It's a portal. It's creating a perspective. The animal's making a perspective just for the person in the video. And that's like one thing, too, I kind of bring up with a lot of these, like, scroll on Facebook for 10 minutes in any Bigfoot group or any paranormal group. You're going to see so many AI images of Sasquatch. And I tell people this, okay, why in the past 2 or 3 years do we have like a couple hundred, I guess hundreds now, of images of Sasquatch and Dogman and all these other cryptids? So like, well, think about it. For the past 60 years, we've only had maybe 10, 20 good images. Why in the past couple years do we have always dozens and dozens of good images? Well, we got to look at what's the correlation between this and the creation of AI and the creation of like Photoshop before it. Like, you have to look at the correlation between not just what's happening in the woods, but also what's happening with technology. Technology and research go hand in hand.
Well, and not only that, you really do have to look at, once again, that end motivation. I will always say, Ryan, I support and believe any experiencer until proven otherwise. I have had my own experiences that are fully unexplainable, and people were right there in the room with me when they happened. Even my sighting of a cougar in Louisiana, there were people around that campfire with me. Screw you, Ricky, my cousin and my brother. I am telling you right now, I saw a jaguarless. It was huge. It was big. And there were people right there with me when it happened. Nobody else saw this thing. Okay.
No.
However, it's one of those, we have to be willing to take a step back from that. We have to be willing to accept the fact that while we can believe everybody, for a true experiencer, it's rarely worth the effort to come forward. And then I will give two examples. Number one, Betty and Barney Hill. I am good friends with Kathleen Martin, the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, and she has had her own experiences of abduction, things like that. But she was warned by her aunt during the investigations and stuff that, honey, if this ever happens to you, you keep your mouth shut. Don't you tell anybody. It's not worth the upset of your life to tell somebody about your experience. It's not worth it. And Travis Walton, you know, and his friends, whose friendship deteriorated over the years. But like, good God, man, Mike Heston Rogers, his buddy, like, lost national logging contracts. They were all suspect of murder during the days he was gone. Like, they took polygraphs to the fact that they didn't murder him in the woods, man. You know, like, that stuff will change your life. It will change the way you're looked at in a community and on record for the rest of your life. you know, and it's not in the vested interest of the average encounterer to come forward. Now, here's the thing. It is in the vested interest of a lot of people to put content out on the topic and to make content on the topic and to create original, sensational content on the topic. It didn't used to be. It used to be extraordinarily hard to put forth fakery and to make a rouse with it and to get a community going with it. It's extraordinarily easy now. To the point that, like, the technologies are to the point where my nine-year-old can use them. My nine-year-old knows how to use this program that we're using to record this.
Wow.
He knows how to use Photoshop and things like that.
He's also your kid, Chris. So
true.
He has your gift as well, I can see.
But I'm telling you, man, like, these are you teach junior high students. It's a junior high students are no stranger to Photoshop and putting things into images and making images and making videos and viral videos. And all of that stuff is monetizable now. It did not used to be. So what was the vested interest? Other than getting it over on a few people.
I think about, like, on YouTube, for instance, I always see videos and channels out there, like, 100 encounters of Dogman or Bigfoot encounter compilation. And I'm like, well, how much of these are not real? Like, how much of these, like, because one thing I always tell people, like, what you talk about experiencers. For every one person that goes to a researcher like myself or Ken Gerhardt or Lyle Blackbird and talk about I've seen this, there's probably 10 or 20 more that don't go and don't tell people what they've seen. And the idea of, like, making money off this and being viral and, like, it kind of brings in this idea of, like, cult of personality of, like, I have all these stories. I have all these eyewitness testimonies of Bigfoot or Dogman or
I am the source.
UFO. Yeah, and that's when it comes into this is not research and this is the more of the not really fantasy but the monetization, the media aspect of it.
Absolutely.
The TV aspect, not the real like research by the book aspect of this.
Well, and that's just it. That's just it. And once again, it is incumbent on all of us who call ourselves investigators or researchers within these communities to approach everything with a healthy capital S, Superman-esque skepticism. And that is that is a prove me right.
Yeah.
Assume the fact that what you're looking at is just another piece of data and learn to just look at it as another piece of data instead of looking at it as what confirms your belief. Because it should take something extreme to confirm. It should take something no less extreme than the moment that made you believe.
Yeah. No, and that's the thing too, where I feel like skeptic or skepticism has kind of become like almost like a bad word in
a lot of
these fields.
It is.
And I tell people, it's okay to be skeptic, but if you're like maybe like a non-believer, or you're like always wanting to like poo-poo the evidence, that's when it's no longer skepticism.
Yeah.
But skepticism is welcomed everywhere.
A detective is supposed to be skeptical.
Yeah.
For reasons. Because otherwise you get emotionally invested in evidence, or you get emotionally invested in a sight line of investigation that may be parallel to where the actual investigation needs to be. But you're so myopic in your belief and in your held belief that you can't skepticize your way to another way of thinking.
No.
You know, and my job as skeptic, just so you know, folks, the proper job as skeptic is to be looking for the data that changes your mind, to be looking for the data that informs your opinion in a different direction. So my skepticism comes through my informed opinion of what I know in photography, videography, software, all these things. And 20, 30 years of doing it for a living and being a content creator and creating content for people and things like that as part of my job, you know? And renovating images and recovering photos, video, audio for years. This has been what I specialize in and do. So, when I see something that is extraordinary, I shout it from the mountaintop.
Yeah.
You know, but I also will fully say, here's an image right here. Here's a prime example. Let's just say, you know, we have this image of Bohemian Grove, you know, and the Great Owl from 1932. Okay, folks. Now I will tell you right now, this is AI. If you watch carefully on occasion, you'll see this image bounce across the screen over my left shoulder in the background. This is some of our AI artwork. And if you notice, if you zoom in, there are zero actual faces on those people.
Yeah.
Like to a creepy Pink Floyd The Wall-esque looking, yeah. Looking mask over their face. All right. These are not real people. This is not a real thing. It certainly as heck looks that way. Like the image itself looks like a ratty image that was scanned and has the extra bits around the edge, you know? That's how detailed it gets.
Yeah.
So,
no, like,
go ahead.
And that thing, too, of like, there's so many times where people have done that, and it's, you see it, and you're like, this is so realistic. But then, like, what you do, you zoom in, you look at the, and you look at the faces. Like, they, oh, wait, there's no faces on those people. There's something wrong going on here.
Yep. Well, and there was one. And it's to the point now where some of these images are actively shared by media. This is one that was shared by actual mainstream media. It was of the pilot that was shot down in Iran. That was, you know, rescued, everything else. So when you start looking at details, when you start looking at things like the guy in the background, his glasses look like they are just pasted on his face.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at the watches, they're the exact same thing. The flags are not in the proper spots.
Yeah.
For soldiers or on uniforms.
There's
12, not 13.
Yeah. So, little details, guys.
And there's like things like this, you know, like, That's just it. Even the straps that aren't the same color, you know, it's subtle little details like that that are in there that make the difference. Things like, you know, artists and humans have a bad enough time drawing hands. Much less AI. Like, hands are a huge giveaway.
How many times you see six fingers, or you see four fingers, or you see like two pinkies, and you're like, wait a second, that's not right. Like,
but that's just it, man. And even like this is a video that I had my Mid Journey make of the Loveland Frogman. You know, and all kinds of realistic reflections, all kinds of wild stuff. But it's when you learn to spot it, when you learn to see things and learn to spot the types of fakery that's out there and how it's made and some of the things like unnatural facial movements, lip sync mismatches, blinking irregularities, you know, face warping during motion, especially around the mouth. You know, stuff like that, like cheeks, where it starts looking like they're animated almost. It's
And it's something too that I bring up when it especially comes to AI and like faces. Like you've heard the term uncanny valley before.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the idea of like it's so human, but it's not human.
Yep.
And especially with a lot of these AI videos, and like there's a lot of people that can't watch like Nightmare Before Christmas because like claymation and like stop motion animation freaks people out because it's so human, but it's not human.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot, especially with AI videos now, is that when you look at how a figure is moving or a subject is moving, you're like, wait, the human body or like a body doesn't move like that. And that's how you can tell.
I've got two right here, which do exactly that. Number one, here's an image of my son before my niece's wedding, all right? Now, I had it turn him into a Muppet. I had my AI turn him into a Muppet and animate him. Dude, this took less than a minute and a half to create.
Wow.
All around, from the prompt of turn him into a Muppet. And if you look, there's cars moving in the background.
Yeah, there's...
There's motion of the camera, like all kinds of things, you know?
Yeah.
So this is the reality. And I know people that make friggin' Muppets, man. I know people that do this. Like, they could make it look just like this. Absolutely, yeah. 1,000%. But why do that when the AI will do that within moments? And this is one that I show. That a friend of mine did. This is yours truly. This is a prime example. I'm sorry, my 50-year-old body cannot do that. Also, where did my clipboard go? Like,
also, where did your spine go? Like,
yeah.
You have no, there's no bones in a body moving around.
Exactly, like. Exactly. I'm limber, son. Limber.
Yeah.
Limber is the only way. I'm very excited about being on the job site, apparently. And this is one that I created right here. Oh, where'd it go?
I'm having nightmares now for AI coming after me.
And this one, like, this was created using a 360 degree image of a farm. If you look on that UFO as it travels by, you can actually see the reflection of the farmhouse in the that would be like behind the camera perspective.
Yeah,
that's how. And I created this in Notch, which is used to create video games, stuff like that. I made that in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
That took me 10 minutes in Notch. That was the first time I was playing with it. My buddy literally showed me how to make a shape and was like, here's how you put footage in. And I made it. And he was like, hey, that's pretty cool. And I was like, I'm totally, I use it for a video clip in between guests all the time.
Yeah.
But it's a prime example of how good something can look in just 10 minutes of work. With zero knowledge of how to use a program. And once again, you can see the stars reflecting in the object. Yeah.
And
things
and that's
like
the thing
that.
Too, like, but watching this video, like, when it comes so close, it's almost like, it's too perfect of a video. It's like, you can show that to someone, you're like, okay, you know it's AI, but some people could get tricked by that. And you can see it, and you're like, wait, no, it's just, it's moving too perfectly. Or they're like, it's almost like too perfect.
Yeah.
And like how sometimes with human faces, it's almost like that face is like it's too symmetrical at times.
Yep.
Like I noticed a lot of AI photos of like people and stuff. Like
that's it.
Human faces at most of the time is very unsymmetrical. But a lot of times when AI creates one, it's very symmetric. It's all mathematics at the end of the day. It's all numbers. Numbers are like that.
Well,
but when you have something naturally, like a human face like mine or yours,
that's it.
It's natural. It's not mathematic. It's non-symmetrical. It's weird lines, weird little pockets, and AI is hard to make that. Like,
yeah, it's hard to replicate that kind of true randomness.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because AI uses basically the same thing that video game technology uses. It uses fractals. To create repetitive patterns and stuff like that. Like if you look at the leaves of a tree, like it's all fractal nodes. It's really interesting and fascinating, but that's what it uses to do these things. And that's why you start seeing that kind of mirroring and aliasing and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Even with audio, like I'll pop up some audio red flags here and we'll listen to one. Here's a little challenge for you. You know, tell me if this is real or not. Have you ever considered that reality, everything you know, everything you feel, everything you are, might not be what it seems? That the solidity of the ground beneath your feet, the vastness of the sky above, and even the passage of time might be an illusion? Imagine for a moment, just a moment, that you're living inside a hologram. Not a hologram like the kind you see on a credit card or in a sci-fi movie.
So,
one infinitely
honestly, fake.
That is fake.
The abruption of your breath count. It's trying to repeat breath count, but
yeah.
it's it's actually on a pad, and I can, it's 1, 2, 3 seconds, 1, 2, 3 seconds, 1, 2, 3 seconds. And the human breath rate usually isn't like that. You can just kind of, you can get that vibe almost, that feeling that, yeah, you can tell it's a fake audio.
And granted, that is an AI that I own that is trained in my voice. I pay monthly for that so that I can make like 1, 2 minute explainer videos. Believe it or not, folks, doing 2, 3 minutes of proper voiceover work can take an eternity. But I want things voiced in my voice, so I'll gladly write the words and give it to AI to put my voice to, and then I'll make the rest of the video and put out content a whole lot faster. So I don't mind using a tool like that in that kind of way if I can train it. But that is trained by me instead of me reading as it says to do, like, hey, you know, read a passage, like read the first 3 pages of Moby Dick. I gave it 20 minutes of clips of me interviewing guests so that it actually got conversational speed. It got inflections of curiosity, inflections of, getting deep and philosophical, you know, being passionate, that kind of stuff. Instead of, after trying to do a typical voiceover thing where I was like just reading something, I was like, oh, no, absolutely not. Like this is as mechanical as it freaking gets.
Yeah.
So I started chopping up interviews to try.
And that makes sense. I think conversation, you get those inflections, you get those tonal shifts, those mood shifts in your voice. But when you're reading off a page, you don't get that. It's, like what you said, very mechanical, very robotic.
Yeah.
Like, it's like when I'm talking, like when I'm giving a lecture and stuff, like I've realized, like being a teacher, you have those math teachers that are like, okay, here is the equation.
Yeah.
Then you do this movement. Then you have the people like, okay, first let's do this. Okay, then we have to do this. Then we'll make sure you have that tonal shift. You have those inflections. And I'm like, I've realized over my years that, okay, when you have inflections in your voice, it usually keeps people's attention. Like,
dynamics.
When you're really robotic, you're going to make people fall asleep.
Yeah. And that's just it. But that's part of it too, is that, sadly and horribly, good data is not sexy, Ryan.
Yeah.
Good science is not sexy science. And we have to make science sexy again. We have to make the boredom of science sexy again. The repetition, like I love the show Skinwalker Ranch. All right. There's some wild stuff going on at that place. I've heard about it for decades, man, in the communities I've in. And the one thing that cracks me up more than anything is the people in the communities who are like, oh, what, did they launch a rocket at it again? And it's like, oh, you mean, what, did they do the repeatable science again?
Yeah.
Like, the one thing they know that happens is whenever they launch a rocket, something goes down. And they can record it and get data. So you know what you do? You keep launching rockets, dude. No matter what you're doing, launch a rocket while you do it. You know? Like, hey, John's going to go to the bathroom again. Shoot up a rocket. See what happens. Yeah. You know, like, that's the repeatable science. Is it sexy?
Yeah.
No. It's science.
No, like with cryptozoology, everyone imagines the guy with a hat in the middle of a jungle with a machete going through the jungle. Yeah. It's like, that's the sexiness of it, but that's not the reality mostly. Like, it's more like, okay, it's going to be, you're sitting in the woods for 20 hours listening for something to make noise. Like, when I take people on, like, investigations and looking for, like, Bigfoot and stuff like that, they expect finding Bigfoot, which I love that people don't find Bigfoot. But remember, it's a TV show. They clip down 10 hours of footage into 30 minutes.
Yeah.
If you're going to be out there in the field, you're going to be out there for 8-10 hours.
Well,
not,
and don't forget,
30 minutes.
It's called finding Bigfoot.
Yeah.
So, still finding.
Yeah.
It's kind of like,
it's not called explore. It's not found Bigfoot. It's finding.
It's kind of like, that's why they call it fishing, not catching. You know, you're gonna spend a lot more time fishing than you do catching. And I'm sorry, but that's the show. is fishing. So yeah.
You may talk to any hunter. How much are you in the woods waiting for your quarry to come and not actually shooting a gun? Like, so many hunters I talk to, they're like, "Oh yeah, I go shooting. I shoot like 2 times in a year." I'm like, "You're a hunter." They're like, "Yeah, I take two buck and boom, I'm done."
Yeah.
But you're in the woods for 2 weeks out of the year, maybe.
Yep.
But you only shoot 2 animals because that's what hunting is.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's what this is supposed to be. It's the fact of, and the example I typically give, there's a gentleman in one of the UFO communities I belong to that lives in the San Antonio area who doesn't post as much as he used to, but used to post very, very regularly for like a year and a half, 3, 4, 5 times a week. You know, like, "Oh, I recorded these lights last night at like 2 a.m. And it's like, Lord forfend, it might be one of the 3 airports that surround you. You know, especially if they're happening, like, if it's happening on such a basis that you're recording it 4 or 5 nights a week, is it still anomalous?
Yeah.
Like, seems like you'd be able to sell tickets to it, or at least like the Marfa lights, where, sure, still unexplained, but there's an observation center.
even with Marfa, like, it happens regularly, but not regularly enough that you're like, "Okay, I'm gonna go out there at this time, it's gonna happen."
But like, you go out there any night after sunset, and chances are bang on 78% that you're gonna see the Marfa lights.
Yeah.
Like, no doubt. Like, they're gonna be out there, and it's fascinating. It's fascinating. But at that point, once again, why are you not creating an economy? If you can 75-80% of the time have a sighting, why is there not a localized economy around your neighborhood? Why is there not a food truck at the end of your street? where's the observation tower and the hourly tickets? Where's the group discount on
There's gotta be at least one taco truck, like Alien Tacos.
Like,
I'm just
wondering.
You gotta do it.
If it is that regular, you know what I mean? So I say that same thing in all true hearted skepticism, in the fact of, please feel free to prove me wrong. I am looking for you to prove me wrong. Show me the hot spot with the trail cams that 85% of them are coming up with these images, and all the images are of the same thing and in the same circumstance and all that. We'll talk. I'd love to see the hot spot.
Yeah, it's the same principle of, like, when you talk to people, like, "Well, I have Sasquatch on my property." I'm like, "Okay, you have Sasquatch on your property. I see him at least once a day." I'm like, "Well, if it is that occurring that often, where, like, I hate to speak, I was one of those people, but where are the photos? Where is the evidence? Like, if you know exactly where they are, there should be data to help support that. I'm not saying it's not real. I'm not saying that it's not happening. Because, like what you said, I'm not going to take away from any experiencer, but at the same time, if that data is that regular, you should have something to kind of back up what you're saying. Like, if you have an amazing, astonishing event happening, you should also have some good data to help support it.
Well, and, you know, I'm trying to, it's interesting because I use a different profile on my graphics computer than my personal profile on Facebook. I have an avatar, and that's what's dialed in. So, you know, private data isn't shared, messages from friends and things like that aren't shared. And I'm trying to find in the communities this image. I could probably go through and send it to myself. But it was, and it was in the Sasquatch communities. This person was talking about a picture that was sent to them by someone in their research group who, you know, in the last year or so has started gifting pretty hardcore on their property, and, you know, apples and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, they've been gifted back before, but never like this. Like, wow. And it was a picture of, like, scat on a garage door. And once again, skeptic in me, former youth minister in me, former substitute teacher in me that dealt with junior high and high school kids, former kid who had punk kid friends and who did some punkly kid things, you know?
Yeah.
You know what kids are prone to do on a Friday night? If they're bored, go find somewhere to throw some poop.
Yeah.
Just say, like, out the gate, let's just all admit it, any bored 15-year-old boy on a Friday night will find somewhere to put the poop he finds. Okay? and it may be your door. It might be for no good reason. 0% good reason. But the percentage chance of it being that punkly kid, like, did you talk to your HMO? Or not your HMO, but your HOA.
Yeah. HMO. I was like,
you may want to talk to your HMO too. But that was, my only comment in the community group that it was posted in with the image was, it's Bigfoot's house now.
Yeah.
Like, he's obviously marked his territory and told you his opinion, so you should just move along.
Yeah. No, like, and that's the thing, you see those in the groups all the time. Like, I remember there was a video, it was going around a couple months ago. It was like a dog barking at a fence, and then you see this creature jump over the fence, attack the dog, doesn't do anything, and then jumps back over the fence. And everyone's like, oh, it's a video of a dog man. It's this, it's this. And I remember watching it, and I'm like, how this thing is acting doesn't make any sense. Like, if you're most animals, if you're getting barked at by a dog, you're not going to jump over the fence, try to attack the dog, and then jump back over the fence. And I looked at the movement, how this animal, and I'm like, this isn't realistic. Like, it's how it's moving in its back legs and in full front legs. It's the biomechanics just doesn't add up to a biological species. And so many people were like so adamant that, oh, I've seen this. And it's like, well, have you seen this? Because this is something that's most likely AI generated. And like what we said, that belief of wanting to believe so much that you're kind of willing to go against what's logical anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was just it for me at that moment with that post in that group, was we have suspended reality now in the what should be plausible and possible and logical.
Yeah.
And a group of supposed researchers here. And you have put forth something that makes zero sense. Like, why would what a blessing from the big guy be the first place that you go to?
Yeah.
When you find your garage scattered upon and then it's with poop strewn all over the door.
I'll even go to the next step of like, okay, you think this is Sasquatch scat? Collect a sample of it. Take it into your local veterinary, local DNA evidence, and see what we can find.
Yeah.
And well, let's be honest, it's probably going to be something else, not Sasquatch related, but take the evidence. If that is what you think it is, let's grab it. Let's see what it is, and let's try to prove it.
Well, and that's just it. That's you know, something that we have to be willing to admit regularly, Ryan, is that it's not going to be a video. It's not going to be a picture that proves it. It's not going to be an audio recording. It's going to be something biological. It's going to be a scat sample, a fur sample, a track with fur trapped in it, with dermal ridges or even oil alleles, what have you.
Even, like, one thing I talked to a lot of people about recently is environmental DNA.
That's it.
Like, I tell people, like, okay, if you see a Sasquatch print, one thing I've thought about recently is what you should do is collect a sample of the dirt at the bottom.
That's right.
And take a collection of that dirt and see if there is environmental DNA within that dirt to prove what made that footprint. And if we get enough of that data of, like, okay, unrecognized primate, we can find that correlation. Like, okay, if we have all these footprints of an unrecognized primate, they're 13, 14 inches long, they have all this morphology, what else could it be? But that's also the thing I talk to people a lot about DNA. We have no Bigfoot DNA. So there's nothing really to count it against, because when you have a bear sample, okay, we know what bear DNA looks like. We know what human DNA looks like. Yeah. We don't know what Sasquatch DNA looks like. So when we get genetics, it just comes as unrecognized primate. And what I kind of have brought the idea about before is, what if we collect all the unrecognized primate samples we've collected over the years and look at all of them together and say, okay, are all these the same sample from across the United States? Because there have been examples of people bringing hair and saying, well, this is marked as primate, but it's an unrecognized primate. Why don't we look at all those samples and compare them to each other and see if they are all the same? Then that's a correlating of an unrecognized species.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it, man, is even with that data, you know, we have to be careful. We have to be able to prove that data. We have to be able to back that data up with proper credos and science and that kind of stuff. And the one closing phrase I use every time I present about spotting fakes, that kind of stuff, like what we were talking about tonight, is in an age where anything can be created, the real skill is knowing what not to believe.
Yeah.
I
completely agree with that. Like, what I tell, like, I'm a middle school teacher. Like, I tell my students all the time, and you hear in school all the time, collecting your data, collecting your points of references is what's most important.
Yeah.
Because right now, the biggest separation is going to be between, like, not just classes or smart kids versus the kids that don't have the best grades. There's going to be people that can think and the people that can't think. Because right now, just across the board, cognitive thinking and figurative thinking has kind of gotten away from people, especially with AI. And if I can make a 10-page essay using AI, let me just do it. And they don't have that cognitive skill. And I tell students all the time, I tell people, even adults, be the people that can think. Be the people that can actually ask questions, because right now, everyone's asking their questions to AI, and that's not what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to create the questions ourselves and answer them ourselves, because in this world, what separates the people that are successful or not successful are people that are going to have good research are the people that can ask the questions and not rely on another tool to ask the questions for them.
Yeah, no, precisely. And we have to be the ones with the curiosity. We have to be the ones to be willing to take two steps back and look at things in a critical way, you know, and be willing to do that, be willing to even criticize ourselves and the means by which we examine things. So, Ryan, I want to thank you, as always, for coming on, for covering these hard topics that so many people do not want to talk about or truly address in our communities, man, because it's huge, it's out there, it's looming, and it will come home to roost, is the only way to put it. So thanks, as always. Let everybody know where they can go to follow your work, where they can go to keep up with you, where they can go to get your books, all that kind of good stuff.
Of course. Well, I'm available on both my Facebook and my Instagram account, Ryan Edwards Cryptozoologist, if you look that up. My books are available on Amazon.com, also on Curious Realm Shop. If you look at Cryptids of the World by Ryan Edwards, also Beyond Bigfoot, the Other Unrecognized Primates of North America, and Sasquatch of Prehistory. All these books about cryptozoology, just the world of the unknown, how cryptozoology is proving through data and hopefully through sciences that there are unrecognized species out there and animals have not yet been discovered. So if you're interested in just cryptozoology or the unknown, look me up on my Facebook or my Instagram page, and I'm always looking for my books, and I appreciate you having me on tonight, Chris.
Absolutely, Ryan. It's always more than a pleasure catching up and talking with you. Always great having you come on and really deep dive into these things that are facing our communities. Hold the line real quick while we close out this segment real quick with the audience. While you are online, everybody, checking out all the amazing work of Ryan Edwards and getting your copy of his books right over there at curiousrealm.com/store. Make sure to visit curiousresearch.org. That is where you can find all kinds of documents, not just our archives there, but all kinds of research documents, winged encrypted sightings, alien contact, the Department of War Pursuit files, all kinds of things, as well as your copy of the field observation and encounter log if you're a investigator in the world of paranormal, UFO, UAP, cryptozoology, if you're out in the field, if you're out taking witness statements, things like that. The field observation and encounter log is your back pocket field log to be able to put down all of your data in the field as it happens, so that you are ready to shake hands with science with your data come the day you need to do so. Thank you so much, as always, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity cannot march forward and does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.